Welcome, everyone. I'm not going to wait for latecomers. They have to drag in here whenever they're coming because we have a very packed agenda and some very important work to do. Yes, Bill, you can come in and just plop the hard drive down there and I'll do the rest. Thank you, Bill. So, some administrative matters. Maria, in Swedish government, my co-chair, is very sad that she could not be here. She sends her regards, and she is definitely following what we are doing, as I noticed when she felt that she had not really copied, that Paul, myself, and Chris had not really copied her enough on some email exchanges, she told us. We are behaving much better now. We should have a scribe. Chris? We have someone that keeps track of the jabber. Do we have someone? Yes, thank you very much. When going to the microphone, later on when we have discussions, which I hope we will have, please state your name and affiliation, and then try to speak clearly so everyone both hears you and understands you. With that, of course, I didn't tell you who I am. Patrick Feldstrom from Cisco, one of the two co-chairs. The agenda for the meeting, we have a review outcome of the RIPE-NCC roundtable meeting, Paul Rendek. Myself will present what the status is in the preparation of the IGF. Roland Perry will talk about the ITU IPv6 group report. We also are working on this week, as was presented on the plenary on Monday, working on a potential statement on IPv6, on this ITU IPv6 work that ITU is doing. And the proposed text is that RIPE gives RIPE-NCC a mandate and also ask them to please be very active and work with ITU. And then we have any other business. And part of any other business, we have one presentation from Constanze regarding IPv6 deployment in Germany. So that's what the agenda looks like at the moment. Any concerns, any issues, any questions on that? Good. With that, Paul.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Paul Rendek from the RIPE-NCC. Welcome to the session. I've actually rejigged the slides a little bit. I've called this the Internet Governance Update because I'm actually going to talk about what came out of our roundtable meeting in February earlier this year. But I'm also going to touch a little bit on the IGF and kind of prep things for the larger picture for Patrick to take over. So, all right, our roundtable meeting for 2010. It was held in Amsterdam, 22nd of February. We had 38 participants there from 12 countries. It was slightly smaller than some of the other roundtables that we saw, but we think it was just because of scheduling, and things are getting very busy, even for the governments and the governance circles. So, of course, there's a lot of things that need to be attended. Some presentations, something different from what happened normally. When we first started these roundtable meetings, it was all about the RIPE-NCC and some of our industry partners actually just spilling as much information as we could to the governments to try to bring them up to speed or try to build relationships. This time around, for the first time, we actually had industry partners and governments come and present at the roundtable meeting. It was brilliant because actually some dialogue came out of that amongst the governments themselves, and it was something interesting for us to take home. So this time around, we had a presentation from the European Commission on some of the V6 activities that they've got. We had a presentation from the German government, also about their V6 allocations and their experiences working with the registry system. It was really great. They had a lot of things to say to their government colleagues at our meeting, so that was quite nice. We had the International Chamber of Commerce. Aisha Hassan came. This was actually quite nice for us because we could see that we showed the government some solidarity between the business community and the internet technical community. So a lot of our positions are much the same, so it was nice to have the International Chamber of Commerce there to show what the business community is doing. And, of course, we had the RIPE co-op working group chairs there, and they also, well, Patrick was at this meeting. Maria could not attend that meeting, but Patrick actually also presented at the roundtable. So a little change in the focus of this meeting. We actually did not have IPv6 as an agenda item per se at this meeting, and this was at the request of the governments because we have spent a lot of time in roundtable meetings updating them on V6, and this time they said, we don't want to hear about V6. We think you've told us enough about that for now. Let's move on to some of the other issues that you have. So the change that we had, and I think the most interesting focus that we had in the meeting was instead of the RIPE NCC actually just speaking to the governments and saying, here's information that we think you need to know, we actually came and asked the governments to support the RIR system for the first time quite actively because the governments have been saying to us, well, okay, this is all great, RIPE NCC. It's good that we've got all this information, but what is it that you want from us? What is it that you want us to do for you? So this time we did explain to them that obviously the internet technical community, as many of you can see, are spending quite a lot of resources in the area of internet governance. We've been very active. We feel we've been a good participant. I think also it's safe to say that the internet technical community is very firmly planted in the internet governance environment. And that's taken quite a lot of effort from all the different industry partners that are there. So we actually did call upon those governments and we said, hey, we have been a group that has given a lot of resources to this. We've done what we can in the area of cooperation with you, and we feel that we want the support from governments now, certainly in specific with the RIR system. So the future of roundtable meetings, yes, we will continue to have them in Amsterdam. We are enjoying the relationships that we've built with governments. We know they are coming. They're starting to ask us a lot more questions. But what we can see is that we're starting to gain some regional popularity. So what we're looking at, the Middle East is also a part of the RIPE region. We hold these roundtable meetings in Amsterdam. It's easy for people in Western Europe, anyway, to come into the city, come have a one-day meeting, and then get home. I've been approached by quite a few Middle Eastern governments that are saying, oh, okay, well, this is all very interesting, but wouldn't it be nice to have something in our region? So just to make it a little fair, I've actually gone out and I've spoken to the Jordanian government and I've also spoken to a few folks at the ICT in Qatar, the Qatari Ministry of Telecommunications, and I'm working with them to try to see if we can hold roundtable meetings, one on the one side of the Middle East and one on the other. So we're hoping to get that off the ground quite soon, and of course we'll report to you on any of the findings that we have there. Just to let you know why some of us have bags underneath our eyes, this is actually the internet governance outreach that we've done since the last report that we gave you at this meeting. There's been a lot of activity. Of course, we do this not only alone. We do this really much, very much in great cooperation with the other RIRs and with industry partners as well. I'm not going to run through this whole list. You can see that we've gone to meetings, various governance meetings from, you know, governments and LEAs and even some enterprise events. We're enjoying the relationships here. We're starting to get invited to a lot of events without having to try to push ourselves in, which, again, is a nice thing to be recognized as a community. But these slides, of course, will be online, and you can take a look at where we've been. And if you have any questions, I'm here the rest of the week. I can tell you what our presence was at any one of these events. So moving on to the NRO statement on the IGF continuation. As some of you may know, the last IGF in the series of the five is coming up this September. So at the fourth IGF in Sharm el-Sheikh, which was in Egypt, was held in November of 2009, there was quite a kerfuffle going on over what was going to happen, what were the positions of the various sectors, was it business or the ICT, on how the continuation of the IGF should go. Well, the RARs got together, and underneath the NRO umbrella, we did issue a common statement. And I've listed some of the, I've just pulled out some of the statements in this communique. I'll give you the URL in a minute so you can all go and take a look at that. We actually were given a slot inside the IGF to review this, and there was a video that's been made, and we've linked the video into this so you can go and actually see my colleague from AFRINIC, Liliana Sharpley. She read this out to the whole IGF community. But some of the key areas that we touched on there, we actually have listed that we have actually participated in the IGF process even long before the IGF process in WISIS. We've been representing the interests of our communities and our members from the developed and developing regions right from the onset. We can see that there's a lot of focus in IGF on the developing regions of the world as well, and I'm happy to say that we believe that the ICT community has got all the areas covered, developed and developing. The NRO supports an environment where all stakeholders can participate openly and equally. This is something that we're very comfortable with because we like to operate like that in our own constituencies. So we believe that this multi-stakeholder approach is very important in the IGF. The non-decision-making status of the IGF, we believe that this facilitates very valuable discussions. We think that it inspires the decision-makers there, many governments that go home and make public policy. We hope that this informs them and inspires them to make the right decisions. The NRO also urges greater efforts to facilitate remote participation because if there's so much emphasis put on the developing regions, then having events like this that pull together, you know, a few thousand people is brilliant, but not everybody gets to join. So what are we doing to actually promote greater remote participation? I think that's what's going to bring some of the developing world into this scene a bit quicker. And the NRO is committed to engaging with and financially contributing to the IGF. We have been a contributor ever since the start of it, and we encourage other stakeholders, all the way from governments to the business sector, to actually join us in this effort as well. So the statement on the IGF continuation, it was delivered directly from our directors to the Undersecretary for the Economic and Social Affairs of the UN, Mr. Shah, and that statement was actually delivered to him in hand, and it was also presented at the meeting. I've given the URL here where you can find that statement, read it for yourself, and also take a look at the video. Lillian did a very nice job in delivering that. So what is our presence going to look at the IGF in 2010? So before I hand the floor over to Patrick to give us a larger picture, I just wanted to kind of give you an idea of what we as RARs have actually done to come together to prep us for what we're doing out there. We have three workshop proposals that we've submitted. Apparently they've received about, oh gosh, I think it's been somewhere in the order of 90 to 100 proposals for workshops. I think they're going to have 80, if I'm correct. Patrick will touch on this. So out of those, we actually, as the NRO, put three in. Naturally, we would like to do something on IPv6, where we want to touch on enhancing transparency in internet governance and openness. This is something, obviously, that's quite dear to our communities, and maintaining the open architecture of the internet within critical internet resources, which we would call here internet number resources in our constituencies. So those are the three. Maybe not all of these will be accepted. We hope that at least one of them will be accepted. We will probably be asked to merge some of these together. We will do so. We're actively looking for industry partners to realize these workshops because they do look at the diversity of the different groups that are going to be participating in your workshop. Last year, we did a great job in working with a bunch of industry partners. We even worked with the ITU to throw a successful IPv6 workshop. So again, this year we're going to be doing the same thing. This is being run by my colleague Chris Buckridge and by Roland Perry from the RIPE NCC, so we're leading that up with the other RARs this year. And of course, we will have active participation. Our directors will be there. We will plop them where we think we need to have them, inside speaking slots for our, under critical internet resources, but we also have various other RARs getting involved in other areas of the IGF. So that's just a quick look at what we're planning on doing for this year. And that brings me to the end of the update. Does anybody have any questions for me?
Thank you very much. So maybe there are more questions after I presented my stuff. Let's see. Then I don't see the slides. Okay, never mind. Yeah, so Curtis pointed out that I wrote the slides, so I should know them. I don't have to see them. Okay, so I will talk a little bit, go a little bit more into detail on the status of the of the work regarding the IGF. It's a little bit. It will be a little bit. Strange to talk about it, as you will see, because there is the first major preparation meeting exactly next week in Geneva, and a lot of things actually depends on what's happening at that meeting. But let me show you a little bit on what's happening. The next meeting, the fifth IGF meeting in the first series of five, is in Vilnius in Lithuania. For those of you that don't really know, it's like here, and it's actually not very far away. It only takes about 16 hours to get there from here, so, and it's not until September. But of course, to prepare a big meeting like this, there need to be a lot of other meetings as well, as if we didn't have enough of them. But the serious part is that we have three preparatory meetings. The first one coming next week, May 10 to 11 in Geneva, followed by a closed meeting in a group called the Multi-Stakeholder Advisory Group. That is a group of appointed people, I think the order of 30 or something, which discuss what Paul mentioned, for example, what should actually be discussed at the conference. What are the workshops that should be approved, etc.? Who should be the speakers? What should be the format of the meeting? Should there be just presentations, or should it more be people discussing things on the stage? I have been myself a member of this multi-stakeholder advisor group from the beginning, and I recognize a few other faces in this room. Nowadays, I'm no longer a member of this multi-stakeholder advisor group, but I'm an advisor to the chair, Nitin Desai, so I'm still part of the work still. There have also been scheduled a second preparatory meeting in June 28th and 29th that will be used if it is the case that the multi-stakeholder advisor group feel that that is needed. The earlier IGF meetings has been in November. This one is in September. Given that I live up in Scandinavia on the same latitude, I know that it's much nicer weather in September than in November, so maybe that's a good thing. But anyways, one of the reasons why the meeting is in September is that, as I said in the beginning, this is the fifth meeting out of five IGF meetings that were scheduled. What is happening in parallel is that there is a review process going on that will lead to a proposal that will be put forward to the United Nations General Assembly later in the fall of 2010. I don't know the schedule in top of my head, but we talk about very late November, early December. The General Assembly will then literally vote on whatever that proposal contains. As you will see a bit later, many of the stakeholders, and specifically here in Europe and in the RIPE region as a whole, has asked the United Nations and the Shaw to extend the IGF to have more meetings than now Vilnius, which could be the last one. It's even the case that Kenya has stood up and said that they are happy to host a meeting in 2011. But the actual decision on whether there will be more meetings is taken in the United Nations General Assembly, which means that countries vote. That's specific decision is not multi-stakeholder according to the IDF process. It's following the standard UN process as part of ECOSOC. We have another list of another timeline which has to do with the deadlines. And these are the deadlines, the dates that people that would like to present or like to participate in the meeting in Vilnius, they have to do things before these dates. And as you see, many of them have already passed. And the reason for that, of course, all these dates, 30th of March, 15th of April, 30th of April, the reason why those deadlines are so early are, of course, that what people have done according to those deadlines is, of course, what will be discussed next week in Geneva. So if we look at, for example, 15th of April, that was the deadline for providing proposals for workshops, best practice forums, etc. We have approximately 100 proposals on the table, as Paul mentioned, but experience from the previous year plus the layout of the conference center itself means that we must go down to 50. So, which is much, previous year it was about 20% that we had to sort of encourage people to withdraw or merge their workshops. This time it's 50%. And that will be a pretty interesting discussion next week, how we are going to do that. It might be the case, what we have been talking about, is that we are going to evaluate the workshops on whether the topic is unique. If there are multiple workshops that talk about similar things, we will encourage people to merge. If it is the case that you have a workshop or a best practice session, for example, with very few organizations that organize in it, it might be the case that that get lower priority. It might be the case that sessions that we identify as being reporting back from, for example, local IGF meetings and stuff, will be encouraged to instead do a video or some kind of other kind of material that can be presented online. It doesn't really need to be a complete take a complete slot at the conference. But all of this will be discussed next week. So after Wednesday next week, I can tell you much more, and you will see much more on the website. The current proposal for the conference of the main topics are the following. You can read yourself. There are a couple of new ones here: internet governance for development, and specifically that under emerging issues should be talked about cloud computing. And of course, these are the kind of meetings where words like that are not so precisely defined. So don't ask me what is meant by cloud computing. That's sort of part of the whole idea. But these main themes might actually change next week based on the input that people sent in on what they think and what people will say next week. If we look at one of the main themes that is specifically important for the RIPE region has to do with critical internet resources. The main theme has these sub-bullets or sub-themes: status of IPv6 availability, specifically examples and case studies, internationalization of critical internet resources management, the importance of new TLDs and IDNs for development, enhanced cooperation, etc. Maintaining the open architecture of the internet. Maintaining internet services in situations of disaster and crisis. And of course, the main sessions are not very long, so the question is how they're going to, like, just one of these bullets is big enough from my perspective to be a conference by itself, but they're just sub-bullets for one session, okay? So that's where we are regarding the IGF in 2010. I wanted to look back a little bit on the IGF last year. Sweden was the presidency of the EU, so we had our minister down there. And this is actually the slide that I wanted to show you on behalf of the Swedish government. It was also that I showed this slide also at the meeting in February. And these were the messages that the European Union, that Sweden presented on behalf of the European Union at the IGF 2009. And it might be the case that to remember that this was actually what, at least like now, Europe is a small part of the right region, but I wanted to show this anyways. And a part of this you see specifically that there was interest from the European Union to extend the IGF another 5 years, continue to be multi-stakeholder, continue to be a non-decision body, etc. And that was all. Any questions? Good, because then we can move into the real discussions. So, Roland, I think you're the...
Okay, my name's Roland Perry. I work with the RIPE NCC on public affairs issues. What I'm going to try to do fairly briefly is give an introduction to the ITU, an introduction to their recent thinking on IPv6, and conclude with a summary of a report that came out of a meeting that was held in Geneva about a month ago. So I thought I'd do this in terms of a timeline. Now, the ITU has been thinking about IPv6 and indeed IP address allocation for quite some time. However, as an organisation, it runs on a effectively four-year time cycle. And so I thought I'd just restrict myself to the major events in this current four-year cycle. And they tend to have all kinds of conferences and forums and council meetings and things like that, where each time a new meeting comes along, resolutions are put in front of the meeting, those resolutions typically edited a bit and passed, and then that goes on to the next meeting. So it's like a kind of a rolling ball going along from one to the other. And so in this particular four-year cycle we're in at the moment, which incidentally ends in October this year, the WGIG in 2005, there was some comment about allocation policies needing to ensure what they call balanced access on a geographical basis. Now, the ITU, along with lots of other organisations, has its own jargon, and one of the bits of jargon that crops up over and over again in terms of IPv4 allocation is what they call a historical imbalance. That's their word for it. Our word for it would probably be legacy space. Just by the way that it was allocated and historical accident, that's the way it's turned out. So the first major resolution upon which most of the ITU's work at the moment is based was at a conference in Johannesburg, a WTSA conference. And again, in ITU parlance, they tend to talk about meetings. So you hear people talking about the Johannesburg resolution or the Doha resolution. And so unless you actually know, Johannesburg, that was in 2008, and it was this particular group that got together, you can get a little bit lost. So the Resolution 64 had some words in it, which I've paraphrased here, where they said it would be good to assist developing countries to look at regional needs, to create awareness and training and deployment for IPv6. And it also said that the ITU should study IPv6 allocation. Again, study is a jargon word in the ITU. Everything they do is a study. And in fact, they have study groups and things like that, which go off and do the studying. But they said, we'd want to study IPv6 allocation, especially for developing countries, and report back to the council meeting in 2009. And that's an annual cycle. They have a sort of like a... the council is... I can't remember off the top of my head, I think about 40 of the member states, and it's like their kind of board, management board, that runs the ITU from one year to the next and looks at resolutions and makes sure progress is going on. So the council meeting shortly after the WTSA then passed a resolution which established a so-called dedicated group on internet-related public policy issues. And that belongs in a little bit of the ITU called the Council Working Group on WISIS. That Council Working Group is closed and only member states, just like on the Council itself, it's a member state only thing. Now, how do we go on to the next one? Hold on. Sorry, I skipped too far, I'm sorry. Right. So moving on to the next bit of this timeline, like I said, the ITU has study groups which are populated by member states, but also by sector members who are generally organisations from the telecommunications industry and other interested parties. And study group three is a group that looks at tariffs and charging on for telecoms, and they passed a resolution which suggested that many developing countries would like to obtain their IP addresses directly from the ITU. Soon after that, to take this process forward, the ITU issued a circular to its members, Circular 30, and this asks some questions about IPv6 allocation and IPv6 deployment to feed into the various studies that the ITU was doing. There were 35 responses to this questionnaire, including two responses from RIRs, and we sent in information about the current state of deployment of IPv6. It was all public information that was available anyway, but we formatted it up nicely for them. And then the final next stage was the ITU Council, so this is a year on now, in October 2009, and again they looked at these very same buzzwords, the assisting developing countries and the training and deployment. They also said that IPv6 allocation itself should be studied and report back to the council meeting the year after that. And in order to do that, and remember, we've got the council and a council working group, and then we've got a dedicated group on internet public policy issues, and now yet another group, which is the IPv6 group, where they allowed not just member states, but sector members and various experts to come along and discuss it. And in particular, the resolution at that ITU Council meeting approved a document which was a report from the ITU Secretariat, a document called C09-29, often called in shorthand the C29 document, and these were the proposals that had been put by the ITU Secretariat, which included a reservation of a large IPv6 blocks for the future needs of developing countries, again looking at the equitable access to IPv6, possibility of ITU becoming an additional internet registry, feasibility, again, the scary stuff now, feasibility and advisability of a CIR, that's a country internet registry model, and to assist in capacity building. So that was what the, if you like, the IPv6 group was asked to look at. And so we all trotted off to Geneva on the 15th and 16th of March this year. Two RIRs attended as sector members. That was Afrinic and APNIC. Attended as sector members, and the other three RIRs attended as invited experts. However, since then, in fact, I think quite soon after the meeting, the IPNCC applied to become a sector member, and we are now sector member of both the development and telecom standards parts of the ITU. The report out of this IPv6 group meeting is not a public document yet. It may become a public document. There's still some debate going on between the various member states and other people at the meeting as to whether the document should be public. Clearly, we would ourselves say, yes, we do want this document to be printed and published. The report itself is effectively the minutes of the meeting that we held over those 2 days in Geneva. That report was sent to the ITU Council in 2010 in April, which was about a fortnight ago, and the council meeting itself said that for future meetings of the IPv6 group, and the next one's in September, that the chairman of the group, who's a member state from the UAE, and that the directors of the ITUT and ITUD divisions can decide who are, quote, relevant experts to invite to the next meeting. And this was something about which there was a great deal of debate actually at the meeting as to who was going to be allowed through the door. And I think it's still the case that it's not 100% clear who will be deemed to be a relevant expert. So there's some work to do on that. The other conclusion of the meeting was that the project would be taken forward between now and September by a so-called correspondence group, which is another bit of ITU jargon. A correspondence group is a mailing list, and there's two mailing lists, correspondence group one and correspondence group two. The first one is basically the awareness and education one to encourage IPv6 deployment. The second one is going to look at the issues of basically, is something broken about the way IP addressing is managed at the moment, and if something is broken, can it be fixed within the current framework? And only if enough matters are raised which cannot be fixed under the current regime will this group start looking at possible alternative schemes, which would include, for example, the country internet registry or the ITU getting involved. So the meeting decided to park the question of should the ITU become involved, should it become a registry, should it get an allocation, should it do all those things until after it's looked at, or after the group has looked at the concerns with the current IP address management system, the impact of those concerns, and whether or not we have been able to identify solutions within the current IP address management system. So that's what happened at the meeting. We've got lots more work to do between now and about a month before the September meeting. So effectively, the report from the correspondence groups will be created during August, let's say, so we've got until the end of July to do some work on these correspondence groups to bring them to a satisfactory conclusion and produce the desired result. Does anyone have any questions on that?
Richard Barnes, BBN. So these correspondence groups are a way for people to provide some further input to the ITUT. Do you know who is invited to be to participate in those correspondence groups?
At the moment, I think it is all member states, all sector members, and if you were an invited expert at the first meeting, okay. So if you weren't an invited expert, so you're in luck if you're a member state or you're friendly with a member state. You're in luck if you're a sector member, but and if you were at the meeting in March. But if you're a expert who's hoping to come to the September meeting, then you probably won't get on the correspondence groups.
Jim Reid, following question from Richards. Are those correspondence groups list archives? Are they going to be public, or is this going to follow the usual ITU model of being behind closed doors for members only?
No, I think the correspondence group is a private mailing list.
Thank you.
You can't even get to the page where you'd subscribe to it without being a member. Mm. But they have signed up the invited experts who were at the first meeting to it. In fact, the correspondence groups are running at the moment, but they're completely silent. In other words, all that's been posted in there are a few messages along the lines of, oh, is this working or not? And, oh, yes, it is. So no one's actually posted a, if you like, an opening salvo of comments or remarks. What I'm not sure about at the moment is whether everyone's going to wait until the last week and have a, you know, do a rush at the end, or whether their people are going to start pitching in some comments at the moment.
Paul Rendick, RIPE NCC. I just wanted to touch on this, a little bit on this meeting and kind of what happened inside of that meeting, just very, very briefly, because I think it's worth noting a few countries and organizations and their contributions there. Actually, we're here in Prague, and I have to say that out of the country states that provided, that stood up and provided their consultation to the room, I have to say that the Czech Republic did an absolutely fabulous job in actually bringing statements forward that were very much in support of the current registry system, and they brought forward quite nice arguments on what was happening there. So that's quite nice to see, and we're here, so that's great. Great. I think that Jane Coffin from the U.S. Department of Commerce also needs to be noted here, because she did a very brilliant job at that meeting as well. Other organizations that we could look at, Cisco, Juniper, they did a wonderful job, and ISOC. ISOC was there. They were on there in full force and in good show, and they did a brilliant job as well. So I just wanted to note those. Oh. And another one, Egypt. The comments that came from the Egypt delegation were also very much in favor to this community. So that was also quite nice to see.
It's also interesting to note that although the meeting finished on the 16th of March, quite late in the evening, I think, there has been quite a lot of correspondence on, not on one of these actual formal mailing lists, but on a sort of classic CC list email, backwards and forwards, about the contents of the report, to what extent the report reflects what people remember happened at the meeting. Things like whether the report should be made public or not. So the meeting is still, in a sense, carrying on with various people making their contributions into it.
John Curran, CEO, Aaron. Roland, could you describe why the results of the meeting or the content of the report is actually important to the community? What's sort of at risk given what might be in the report or what might happen to the results?
Okay. The report itself is quite educational in that it lists the contributions made by the various speakers, so you can get a feeling for the position, sort of political position of the various people commenting in there. I think the meeting was, I think, quite a successful one for our community, because we did manage to park the issues of studying how would a CIR work, how would that system work, how would the ITU become a registry. So all of that has just been put on one side until the situation has been clarified as to whether or not there's something wrong with the current system. So the danger to our community is that the traffic on the correspondence group will come to the conclusion, will draw a conclusion, that in fact there are things wrong with the current system, and that therefore the ITU will need to go back and look at the possibility of either a CIR system or possibility of having a block of addresses, IPv6 addresses, reserved for it for future use. Because what the people promoting that plan are worried about is effectively history repeating itself for IPv6, the way they see it as having happened for IPv4. And what they see happening with IPv4 is early adopters and developed countries getting most of the addresses and not leaving enough for developing countries. And so they're just saying simply, we don't want that to happen again with IPv6, so let's have a little secret store which we'll put on the top shelf, and that will come in handy one day when IPv6 runs out. But what we don't want to do, really, is discuss all of that what-if scenarios at the moment, because we're quite convinced our current system will work perfectly well, and therefore we don't need this sort of life raft approach, which is the one that basically all of this process is predicated upon.
Rob Bloxell, I triggered by this ongoing stuff. I took some time a couple of weeks ago and read E.164, and that's a document that is a series of documents, but one of the appendices gives the global telephone number plan. Mm-hmm. It's highly recommended because a quick glance shows that there are three classes of telephone numbers. Let's call them A, B, and C. Then sounds familiar. Class A is a one-digit country code, which means that that is 10% of the whole number space. There are two of these lucky countries, the United States and some of its neighbors, who share this one thing, and Russia, who has the other class A. There are no more class A's available. Then we go to the class B, two-digit country code prefix, which means you get 1% of the global telephone number space. Well, there are countries like the Netherlands, Germany, the UK, in the neighborhood here, and who get that. You think, well, that's apparently if you have between 10, 60 million potential users in your country, that seems all right. Vatican City, which has 768 inhabitants, according to the CIA World Factbook, also has such a block. Larger countries, typically late comers in the world of telephony, got a three-digit country code, which is one per mil of the total. Some of these major countries have a problem with the way these numbers have been distributed. So, if we in the past made some mistakes, as the ITU said, well, we are not the only ones. And they have not shown that they can do better. I think one of these days we should find a way to summarize this and publish it.
And I think I'm very glad you brought up the subject of country codes, because there's a possibility that the ITU is underestimating the amount of work involved in being a regional registry. And I think they may suspect that the only work they're going to have to do would be to use IPv4 parlance, maybe just to hand a /8 out to each country and say, right now, you get on with it. But we know there's a lot more to it than that.
Hi, Fahad. Just to make a comment about something you said earlier, you said that motivator for the ITU is comparing what we've done in the past and saying there were mistakes and it's unfair and growing nations and so on and so forth. But this is only one of the arguments being presented, because it's an easy argument to make. One of the reasons that the main troublemakers, the main screamers or shelters behind this movement are making internally and making on a one-to-one basis to different governments is not how numbers get distributed, because that is a weak argument that can be argued against. And we can simply say, listen, the legacy space is legacy. This was distributed even before the RIR system. So that's not the argument they are using to win support. The argument they're using to win support is having a nation have more of a say in policy making and in number distribution than they currently do. Today, it's being managed and run by the community. A lot of those third world nations don't want the community doing it. They don't want the LIRs and the RIRs having the say. Well, the RIR system is a collection of LIRs. The LIRs have a say. In those countries, that LIR is not on the good political side. So, you know, we don't like them so much. We don't want them to have numbers. We want a CIR to stop giving them numbers so they cannot maintain and grow. That's the real reason that's behind this movement. They're claiming that nation has to have the sovereign right to decide what IP addresses are allocated and where. And that's the big danger to us. Not whether the legacy system and the crap that happened before is an issue or not.
And the elephant in the room is, can that issue be solved under our current system?
Give me a second. What, you're telling me you want to make nations have the right to decide how the internet grows or not? That's the whole thing we're against. You don't want a country to decide whether the internet grows or not. The internet would not be the internet if countries decided what to do. We would not be here in this room if it was run by governments. No. No. No way.
Thanks. Just a couple of comments and clarifications, really. We've got to be very careful here when we talk about the ITU this, the ITU that, because what do we mean by the ITU? There is no common view amongst the ITU membership about what needs to be done here, as there are some people that are very strandedly in favour of this ITU approach of suggesting some alternate form of IP address allocation and management and all the stuff to do with internet governance. There are equally strong and strident views that could be the opposite view, and those opinions are being expressed at the ITU. I think something that's very, very important for this community and others like this is to make representations to their governments, who can then make representations through the sector members as governments, as participants in these study groups, to make sure that your views are held. We can facilitate this dialogue here, but really, if you've got contacts with your governments and your member states, please ask them, what are you doing? What are you going to be saying at ITU about this? How are you planning to vote the upcoming council meetings for the upcoming council seats? How are you planning to vote the upcoming plenipotentiary at the ITU? We've also got to consider, too, that the ITU is a bureaucracy. And, of course, the ITU as a bureaucracy will have its own views and opinions about things. And to some extent, one of the things that I'm still trying to get my head around is to what degree are the opinions that came out of Geneva being expressed by the ITU, the organisation, the bureaucracy, or is it because they're allowing certain member states to align themselves with views that are compatible with their own, and they're allowing that game to be played forward? Mm-hmm. Second point I want to make is to what Fahad was just saying a second ago. There is this fundamental problem that still needs to be grappled with, which is an international law. International resources are not under the control under one member state. And that fundamental is a problem the internet still has to really grapple with, because the internet is an international resource. And however you want to pretend to dress it up, ultimately it's under the control of ICANN, and ICANN is a US government or is tied to US jurisdiction. And that's a problem that needs to be addressed somehow. And that's going to be a long, long, long time sorting that one out.
I'd just like to answer your point. Well, thank you for all those comments, very useful comments. When I talk about the ITU, you've got to realise the ITU is a very input-driven organisation and an output-driven organisation. If it doesn't appear in a document put on the table at the start of the meeting, and if it doesn't appear in the document that comes out at the end of the meeting, then it doesn't exist. Those opinions don't exist. That's why there is so much fighting over exact words that go into the resolutions, exact words that go, and believe it or believe it not, people will spend hours arguing over one word. Okay, I stressed it earlier, this stuff thing about who can be invited to the next meeting in September. It's relevant experts. Hours were spent arguing over that word relevant. Okay, but it's in the report. Okay, so that is what the ITU thinks, because that's the way the ITU works.
Leslie Daigle, ISOC. Just wanted to make two comments, one back to the E164 numbers, and I will also comment, yes, the ITU is also a member-driven organization, and some people in this room might recall what happened when Taiwan was trying to get space in the ENUM directory based on the E164 standard from the ITU. And going back to the whether or not governments will allow the internet to grow in their countries if they allocate IP addresses, I think we've already seen examples of that through the ITU. The other point I wanted to bring up was in terms of the discussions at the IPv6 working group at the ITU in general. You were making the point just now about relevant experts being invited to participate in that process. One of the slippery slopes that this process has, and it's certainly one of the remarks that ISOC was trying to make very clear in the March meeting, is relevant experts can participate in that process to help inform an ITU process, but in no way should that it be perceived as taking the place of having discussions of technical activities outside these forums, the RIRs, the IETF, etc. So relevant experts at the meeting, for sure, but staying focused on making sure that the discussion does not stray from ITU-relevant topics.
Okay. Okay. Which one is it? It's the one that Chris uploaded. In order to efficiently and effectively take this process forward and for us to participate in the correspondence group, we are suggesting that this meeting makes a community statement on IPv6. It follows quite closely the words actually in the conclusion of the report, and particularly the terms of reference to the two correspondence groups. I'll just walk you through it section by section. The first sentence basically says we support the work of the correspondence group one, in other words the education and outreach and assistance in deployment. The next one says, but on the other hand, we've noticed lots of worries coming up in the ITU group that the current management system is inadequate. And what we want to do is to work with the ITU group, the members, and this community to identify the concerns, in other words, to answer this question, what is broken, and then to see if we can also say, and this is how we fix it inside our own management system. So this is a draft. I wanted to keep it short and to the point. And I'd welcome your views on that draft.
Jim Reed. Roland, I don't like the idea of trying to do document edit by a meeting of this size or group like that. It doesn't really work that well. The only minor quibble I have with it, I think the text there is fine, and I think we should just pretty much accept it. One small thing I would quibble about is the end of the second sentence, inadequate to support operators in developing countries. I think probably the view that the ITU study group has, or the V6 group has, is the current address management system is inadequate. It's not whether it supports operators or not. I don't think anybody really cares whether it supports operators or not. They just don't like the current system, full stop. But I wouldn't want to quibble about that. It's just an observation.
Jonas Winnen. I just wanted to ask a little bit about the last part of there. First of all, I totally agree with Jim that let's go forward. This would be good enough. I just want a minor point there. You say that the right community manages the right NCC to work with and so on. That's fine. To clearly identify these concerns and to find ways to address them within the current IP address management system. The question is that should RIPE NCC address that or the RIPE community address that after these issues have been identified?
Okay.
So that's just a question.
Yes. Well, what we're trying to express here, we're trying to capture here, is the idea that the only way that we can work with the ITU IPv6 group is through that correspondence group mailing list. That is the only tool that we have. Okay, the RIPE community itself is not and cannot be subscribed to that mailing list. Okay, only the RIPE NCC and other similar organizations are actually subscribed to that group. So what I'm asking here is for the community to use the IPNCC, probably me, but we haven't actually made that particular decision, to act as a channel between what's going on the mailing list and your views. So my vision of this would be to monitor concerns, and we're not completely in the dark about what these concerns are. One member state has produced a 3-page document listing all his concerns. Okay, it's not a secret, and presumably these will pop up on the mailing list sooner or later. Okay, and then my role would then be to come back to the community and say, okay, this is what's been expressed as a concern. Do we have a way of solving that within the current system? Because that's all we've been asked to do. That's all this correspondence group has been asked to do, is identify the issues and see if they can be resolved. And unfortunately, although the ITU process takes 4 years to go around a big cycle, we've only got until the end of July to input things into this mailing list. So we do need to be fairly swift and fleet of foot in order to participate.
I agree with all the previous speakers that we are not going to do community editing here. I think the statement is as good as it gets. I personally would have used some stronger language, but...
And your name is?
Rob Loxell. Sorry. I want to add to what Roland just said. What this basically says, this statement is, we as a community, we tell RIPNCC, do this. We cannot do this as a community, as we have just learned. That's not how the ITU works. RIPNCC is a legal entity. RIPNCC has some sort of membership in one department of the ITU, so it seems to be an organization where the ITU is at least willing to listen to. This cannot be achieved by the RIPE community. So the RIPE community tells its secretariat, the RIPNCC, do this. And of course the RIPNCC will do this in close cooperation with the community and individual experts from the community. Yeah? Is that the correct understanding?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you.
Hi. So, Stefan, just want to make a very small comment. 2.5 years ago, we had a RIPE community resolution on IPv6, so maybe we should watch out that the titles don't get mixed up and that people are reading the wrong document if it's published somewhere.
Hans-Peter Holen from... Hans-Peter Holen from Visma. I fully support this statement. I think that we can pass this and give RIPNCC this task. Of course, implicitly, we trust you to run this through your own the existing processes, but we don't have to confuse this message by putting that in there. As a side remark, I would remind everybody in the room that has been here for a while that it's not that long ago that telcos also in this part of the world wanted to prevent ISPs, which were a new creation, from getting numbers and getting into this territory. So, I mean, our memory isn't actually that bad. We can still remember that it was a struggle 20 years ago, 15 years ago, even 10 years ago in Europe to fight this as well, when telcos wanted this to be under their control. And there wasn't a distinction between the telco and the government on the time. So, yeah, it's not a new thing.
Curtis Lindquist. So, to follow up what everybody else has said, that maybe we shouldn't do anything here, but I read this slide, I don't know how many times, and I do believe that it might be a bit short. And I think that we are losing some context by trying to produce a very short statement to fit on a slide. I just had two observations. One is that the not all the concerns raised is to support operators. There are a lot of other concerns in there as well. In what was brought to the IPv6 study group or IPv6 group. I don't know if you want to change that wording or not, but it's just an observation. But yeah.
Alain Biron from France Telecom. Thank you. Alain Biron from France Telecom. I have just a question regarding the last part of the sentence. We say to clearly identify these concerns, okay, and to find ways to address them within the current IP address management system. Are we sure that all concerns that can be identified need or can be addressed? If the concern is for some government to take control over the full management of IP addresses, it could be a concern. Should we address it?
I think what we're trying to capture here is that we must work hard to identify what the concerns are. That's the getting it clear part. I think it would be weaker if we put attempt to find ways to address them. But this is...
If needed or recognized as valid concern by the community.
Jeff Houston, APNIC. I've actually been asked to give you a bit of information here. I wasn't in the room earlier, but APNIC at its APNIC 29 member meeting had a community consultation as well on this very same topic. Thank you. And did prepare a statement somewhat longer than this, but in a similar vein. And I don't remember it offhand, but it is on the APNIC website. And as you sort of think about what you're saying here, you might want to have a look at what the APNIC community came up with as a statement and see in what area there is an intersection of interest, because I suspect that there is a very similar theme in these two communities in reacting to where and what is happening with the ITUT. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Yes, I participated in that Kuala Lumpur meeting by remote participation, and since then, the IPv6 group has come up with a mandate for the correspondence group. And what I've done is I've refined it down. I've reduced the scope of this statement to include only those things which the correspondence group has been asked to look at. Now, if the correspondence group finishes its work in July, the report goes to the meeting on the 1st and 2nd of September, there will be another output document and a new mandate for probably a new correspondence group, which will be asking different questions, doing different studies, and then this will be out of date. We'll have to come back in November and ask, what do we now do now that the world has moved on? So I'm trying to capture this moving target as it is from now until the end of July. That's what this is trying to solve. It's trying to solve our problem that we have between now and the end of July. The problem will change on the 2nd of September.
So just the two persons at the microphone, and then we move on. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim Reid, just before I make my comments, Richard Barnes has asked me to tell everybody that he's just posted a link to the APNIC contribution. He stuck that into the Jabber room. Mm-hmm. From what Jeff was saying, I think we have to be careful that we don't end up going around a little bit in circles. The APNIC statement, the community statement was produced, was also submitted as a contribution into the ITU study group or working party that was looking into this thing. The statement of text that we are working on here, to the best of my knowledge, is not going to appear as an ITU contribution at some point. Maybe that will come later. But what we're really wanting to do is give a bottom-up approach that gives the mandate for the NCC to participate fully in these activities, make some constructive suggestions within that particular study group or working party, whatever ITU is calling it this week, and report back to us if there's anything of concern or significance. I think we can all agree with that, and just let's get on with it and get it done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue to discuss this both with each other here and also people remotely and on the mailing list, etc. Rob, do you want to explain a little bit for people in the room what the process is for things like this?
I think if I remember well, the process is as follows. At the closing plenary session Friday morning, after the morning coffee break, I will introduce this statement, and that is the last call for protest, not for editing. And if there is a wide consensus that the RIPE community, as gathered this week in Prague, in that room, supports this, then I think it should be published as widely as possible. And by publishing it, we should explain the status of this document by saying we discussed this in Prague, and the RIPE community, as present at the RIPE 60 meeting in Prague, adopted the following statement. That makes it clear, I think.
Thank you very much.
We have done this in the past with other similar statements. Yep.
So with that, I would like to move to the last item on the agenda. Constante from Ministry of Interior in Germany, please.
Hello, nice to see you. Introduce myself. My name is Constance Berger from Germany, from the Ministry of the Interior. I think everybody knows me. From me come the word. First, yesterday shocked me a little message from Patrick about a similar theme we discussed here. And it was a statement from ZDNet over our ministry. The Ministry of the Interior de Maizière will nationalize the assignment of addresses on the internet. It's not true. There is a counter statement of the site of ZDNet in the following messages. You can read it. A few words to this message. Allocation of IP addresses by government, by German government, is not at all be aspired. The hoax is based on another press reports in which the minister has commented on the general role of government in dealing with the internet. And the passage was not based on the allocation of internet addresses. The minister expressed rather literary in another place the address assignment works, even though it is arranged only by private persons. And you see the counter statement. So let's start to an update of the status in Germany. I think we have done a lot of things. First of April shocked me, or I was very happy about this statement. All IP addresses are taken, ICANN disables root server. And this from a very professional, important news channel. You see, the meaning of V6 is rising. It was a very good message for me. You know our political base. We have a federal system, and it's very hard to get agreements in this system. That therefore we was very proud to get consensus within decision boards representing all administration levels to apply for a common V6 address base. We became a LEAR member, and we got a /26 address base. We was very proud of it. German government set IPv6 as a topic in the final declaration on the 4th German IT summit in December of last year. After that, we built up a working group, a representative working group, and we designed drafts of address concepts and organization concept. Now we need a formal approval of the planned approach within Ministry of the Interior and other decision boards. What we did. Some of you, it's my son. He has to play with with IPv6 addresses. It's one address, a real address, from our block. We started in Germany two programs, some of you knows them, to modernize our communication infrastructure in public administration. The first is Deutschland Online Infrastruktur, It is an infrastructure serving federal government, states, and municipalities. There was implemented DualStack in October 2009. Next steps are implementing of network protection devices. We hope in June if the devices are ready. And the encryption devices in December 2010. And the next information to the NDB, it's Netze des Bundes. It's a network from Common Network for the Federal Administration. This network infrastructure is ready to migrate, and we are in planning, and it's also will be enabled V6. So where's my next slide? What is the statue deployment? We designed drafts. I have to say drafts. There's no confirmation and no... The boards have to say it's okay. Therefore, there's an address draft concept. We broke down /26 in space in 60. We broke down the /26 in 64 blocks of sizes of /32, and we did assignments to federal states, DOE, and Ministry of the Defense. We designed a draft of an organization concept, and this concept describes the independent administration of the /32 blocks by suppliers. DE government, the role of DE government, this describes this organization concept too. In planning is a migration toolset for the users. It will continue operation guidelines, configuration checklists, and address templates. Pilots. We have the first pilots in V6. That's Dataport from Hamburg. Perhaps you know. They want to do voice over IP. Then we have the testbed DOE in the DOE Netz infrastructure by transport and services. And we try to migrate our CIO website. It's very difficult to migrate because this infrastructure or this website is embedded in a very secure infrastructure. So we have many difficulties to migrate. But then we have another interesting project. We set up a research and development project, and in this project we want to develop IPv6 profile for the public administration of Germany. Analog, the US government did it in the NIST paper. It should be include V6 specifications and purchasing guideline, and we would propose to extend it for Europe later. This profile should be transparent. Should bring transparency for the industry and users. Also, we are looking for an update for our IT infrastructure frameworks. This development project includes also a test lab, and we will collect experiences in mobility, multicast services, and on interoperability tests. In this project is involved the Fraunhofer Focus organization. Our next steps: finalization of address concept and organization concept, approval by the German IT Planning Board, starting V6 address distribution, continuing the development project, supporting and facilitating V6 pilots, and supporting European V6 initiatives. We offer to share our knowledge and experience. just a few words about our statements of Germany to the government, no, to the continuation of the IGF, if you are interested in. This forum was established as a new, unique platform for a non-binding multi-stakeholder dialogue. It is the only forum that allows a gathering of representatives from all geographical regions across all stakeholder groups to discuss all aspects of internet governance and on an equal footing. We feel that the lack of pressure to negotiate binding outcomes contributes to frank and open exchanges, and Germany supports a renewal of the IGF mandate. And another statement, we have a statement too to the ITU V6 working group. The ITU initiatives is an attempt aiming at levering the existing mechanism of allocating IP addresses and thus at submitting the management of IP addresses to more control by the state, as the intervention intended by the ITU poses substantially risk of the workability of the internet as an information medium, a platform to do business. Germany does not see many benefits of creating a country internet registry model as proposed by the ITU. From our point of view, it will be important we highlight these problems in the working groups for any support, and this we would be for any support, and this we would be grateful. I think I can say we can support your statement. Thank you for attention.
Any questions? We have another 7 minutes. Anyone else that would like to say something? Questions on what we've done so far? I don't think you want me. No, John is on his way to the microphone. Yeah.
John Curran, CEO Aaron. I just want to relate to this community what I've learned over the last 4 months, having immersed myself in this ITU process. It is not as straightforward as it's been communicated here. The ITU consists of many different study groups and many different meetings and conferences, all of which have the potential to create a work item or action item which ultimately will end up at Plenipot in October to cause a form of action for the Plenipot, which only happens once every 4 years, to add country internet registries for IPv6 to the ITU's agenda for the next 4 years. So we have a garden with lots of seeds, some of which we can see. The IPv6 study group, we know where it is, and we've built appropriate fences, and we're careful to watch our hands. But there's a lot of other ITU groups, and any one of them can create a finding or a referral to another and end up in October with a question or an action item on the agenda for Plenipot. To this extent, I've asked everyone in the Aran region, if you are a sector member, to please coordinate with your RIR, because we need help chasing down all of these. If you have liaisons with a member state directly, a country that's representing, please help your RIR find that member state, because this is a multi-headed thing we're fighting, and we don't even know where all the heads are yet. So I'll ask.
Thank you. And personally, I completely support everything you said, and hope that people noted. Thank you.
Brian Nisbet speaking right now as Anti-Abuse Working Group Chair. Paul mentioned earlier on that one of the activities we've been that the NCC have been engaging in is law enforcement interaction and cooperation. And just to mention to anyone who's interested in such things but hasn't looked at the anti-abuse agenda, quite a lot of the agenda for the meeting tomorrow at 1600 will be dealing with the NCC and the community's involvement with the law enforcement agencies. So if that's something of interest, please come along. It's in this room tomorrow at 1600.
Thank you.
Alain Biron again. I don't know if it is appropriate to address it here, but I would like to ask a question regarding the implementation of the affirmation of commitment. And as you know, the affirmation of commitment was signed, and it was there was some support from NRO on this new framework. And there is, during this implementation of the affirmation of commitment, a series of review teams were put in place, or are going to put in place, the first one being the review team on transparency and accountability. And all supporting organizations are supposed to be represented in these review teams, including the ASO. I've not seen anywhere something described coming from the ASO to populate these review teams. And I was a bit surprised the way the first review team from the ASO was populated. Don't you think that something that could be addressed here and that something is needed in order to have a very clear way to populate these reviews, the review teams?
Thanks, Alan. That's a very difficult question. I think, is there somebody here from the ASO? If this is something that you want to bring up with them, I think that's something that you should bring up with them. I mean, we have a website that has a channel to them. We have an ASO member here. Perhaps somebody from the ASO would like to say something.
Jim Reeds. John Carden mentioned a few minutes ago that this ITU thing has got many, many heads, and some of them we don't even know where they are. Well, there's one of these little heads has just popped up very, very recently, and there's a meeting just around the corner that I think you should know about. Study Group 2-3 is about to meet, and two of the things that are on the agenda for Study Group 3, Freudian slip, was involved with Study Group 2 for far too long. Study Group 3's got things on the agenda which are including, one, the ITU role potentially in internet exchanges. Right. Now for the biggie. There's a proposal coming out of China which is to do with ITU suggestions for exchanges and changes to BGP. And the idea they're talking about there is incorporating telco-type tariff models into your BGP exchanges of routes. I think this is something that concerns some of the people in this room. So if you do have any way of influencing the discussions at Study Group 3, either by making representations to people who are going to be there, or to your member states who may have some involvement in those meetings, I think you better start moving quickly. The deadline for contributions for that meeting is tomorrow.
Okay, we actually have one more minute, so...
Wilfried Weber, Vienna University and Address Council. I'd like to come back to this comment from Alain. First of all, you got me on my left foot. I'm not prepared sort of to give you a... No, that's okay. Just to set the stage. The fact and the reality here is that I guess all of us on the Address Council, and in particular the three of us for this region, we still do have some sort of a day job. And there is lots and lots and lots of things in the vicinity of ICANN which you could get involved with or entangled in if you've got the spare cycles. sort of this is not trying to apologize for not having raised my hand, but just the fact that I myself am for this year on the NOMCOM, and I can tell you this is a little bit of an effort. I guess there are one or two other people in this room who know that, how that feels. But to come to the point, if the community really gets the feeling that it is important that one of the groups, one of the roles, one of the functionalities from within the community actually gets actively engaged in that, then I would really welcome sort of that sort of input, and I definitely take yours as something to review and to think about. There might even be recently have been an extension of the deadline to apply for one of the years for that particular committee. So personally, I will definitely not be in a position time-wise to get involved, but maybe some of the others of the other 14 would be in a position to do so. So I'm going to talk to you privately. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I would like to thank everyone for wanting to close this meeting and thank everyone for coming. As always, please contact me or Chris and Paul or Maria and come up with ideas on what we should deal with next time. And also, of course, use the mailing list. Thank you very much, and thanks for Jake.